about 4 years ago, I was working at Baylor, and I was across the hall from this guy, and great guy. I mean, we talked a lot. We had a lot in common in a lot of ways, but he was teaching this class on org theory. And all the time, it was victimism, organizations of systems of domination. It drove me insane. I mean, I just felt like he was just indoctrinating students with this idea that you're a victim of the system. And I bowed to myself. I go, if I ever get to teach that class, if that's ever turned over to me, I am throwing all that crap out of the window, and we're going to talk about empowerment and agency and making a difference and having some control over your own life. So that day came, and I thought, I looked at kind of the evaluations. They're abysmal because org theory to undergraduate students is still like teaching philosophy to, you know, some guy that just works on the docks and, you know, and has no interest in that whatsoever. It's too abstract. It's so... so I said, all right, I'll do it, but I want to change it to social entrepreneurship. And a lot of my colleagues were absolutely flabbergasted because they knew I was pretty pro-capitalism, pretty much an Austrian at heart, and even many times said, I don't understand, you know, social entrepreneurship, that doesn't fit at all with you. And I said, it fits exactly with me. It's the best thing to take on because I want to show that the free market can actually address this problem and that we have plenty to say about it. And in time, over the last few years, the journals have just proliferated with social entrepreneurship papers. You see them everywhere. The media was so excited about it. It gets so much attention. And I started thinking to myself, what is the enthusiasm? Why is there so much enthusiasm for the subject? What is it exactly? And I went to a conference and I learned very quickly what it was. It was socialist entrepreneurship. It was practically Marxist. What it had become is an exodus of a lot of people that didn't feel like they had a voice now because capitalism had won the day. Classical liberalism seemed like it was up until 6 months ago, seemed like it was now the default position. And a lot of leftist-leaning academics had accepted that and said, okay, now that there's not an alternative system, how can I bring my communal values into the system? And a lot of times they were attracted to social entrepreneurship. And that horrified me in the room because I thought I had a very different philosophy on what social entrepreneurship was, what it could be. And as I listened there, at the end of the speech, I said something to the fact that, you know, if you have libertarian leanings, there's still room under this tent for you. And I thought I was going to be chased out like Frankenstein's monster with the village people with their torches. And so that's when I started developing the class, started thinking really deeply about the subject and thought, how do you reconcile these two? And does Austrian economics have something to say about the subject? And this is very small, so I'm going to walk you through this kind of swimming upstream to find the source of extreme poverty. So I decided, let's make the class about eradicating extreme poverty. But let's not do it from a top-down position. Let's take a different approach to this subject. And why did I pick extreme poverty? Because it was structural. So we could throw out the notion of motivational issues right out the window. And let's focus on structural poverty. And what I found is we had to really start drilling down into assumptions because every student came in with assumptions on why the market was failing. They were signed up for the class a lot of times because they thought it was nonprofit. I didn't want to teach it as a nonprofit. We're going to talk about non-loss, which is a very different concept. And we started walking up the chain and moved to the next thing was economic growth versus redistribution. This was assumption one. We had to really kind of bring to the table and start talking about what's the best way to really bring prosperity to people. Redistribution, despite the fact I was in a business school, had a very strong following. Intuitively, people still thought it was, even when they said they were a free market, when you actually started probing and asking questions and you got into the debate, redistribution just kept coming up, even amongst people that would argue they're fairly free market advocates. Then we'd move up to the next one, and this one was interesting. When I was in Kenya and I was doing some work over there, again, a lot of people that would argue that they were free market advocates, they were pro-globalization, they kept coming back to, how do we help people? Well, we need to create almost like this commune, or we need to break this brand, have their own farm so it's self-sustainable. It was, again, this segregate the people so that you could help them, and somehow that would protect them from the vicious, rapacious capitalist system, and that would allow them to catch up. And this happened over and over. It was almost like the Amish model of economic development is what I started to call it. And so I found that we had to really call this out on the table, start talking. This is all just these were all the steps that we had to take just before I could get to how do you actually help somebody in terms of agency through voluntary action. So we moved up to the next one, and I had to really pick apart what is capitalism. And I took Doug North's approach and just said, let's break it into institutions so it's manageable. And we can talk about each one of these and which ones are absent. Let's talk about political institutions. Political economic institutions are not just assumptions. Let's talk about them as variables. A lot of times the students did not see that, did not understand that these institutions are up for grabs, that they're manipulated in both positive and negative ways to serve the people, to impoverish the people. And we took it up another step, and this was a big one, that markets often fail because of inappropriate government intervention. A lot of times I had to explain that the market was failing not because the market was inherently fallible, but because it wasn't being allowed to operate. And this was another major stretch that when we were in Kenya and I was walking with students, a lot of times they'd have this moral outrage. When you see people in the slums, you'd go into the Kibera slum and you see this. I even felt it, so I completely understand it. I mean, I know how markets work. I understand it philosophically. I believe it. But when you're there, you feel this moral outrage. How can this be? And you look to prosperity around you and you can't help but get the causality wrong and believe those people are holding these people down, rather than understand that poverty is the norm and some have escaped through business and trade has allowed some to escape. Everyone was in poverty at one point in time. And only through a historical analysis do you really see that. That's a complete flip. To do that changes people's perspective, and it's hard to kind of make that the dominant assumption, that poverty is the norm, prosperity is the exception. That was a major kind of shift with people. Then we moved up to the next one. Politicians are self-interested. Government is neither benevolent nor omniscient. This is another wildly held intuitive assumption amongst my students. Again, in a business school, I'm not teaching a liberal arts wing. I'm not over in the English department here. And how do you make this point? So I started showing movies like The Aviator in class, where Senator Brewster, played by the lovable Alan Alda, makes his, in essence, is trying to impoverish and take down Howard Hughes and use the system against him. And kind of, again, to try to win intuitively, to show a deep understanding that you understand that these are not benevolent. The government is not some omniscient servant of the people. It's just people. It's individuals. They're self-interested. They want to stay in power. Sometimes they have benevolent motives, but they're human and they're fallible and they have kingdoms a lot of times that they want to build. So all of this led to kind of the final stage, which top-down efforts to encourage reform, then require – let me read this to you. Top-down efforts to encourage reform often require the complicit behavior of those likely to have their personal situations worsened by implementing reforms. So I wanted them to get to finally to this realization that to try the top-down approach means that you're in essence asking for government leaders in third world countries often to work against their own interests. Okay, I'll wrap it up in just a second. So all of this led to the alternative approach of the bottom-up alternative. But then getting into that, we found that it has a lot of problems as well, and this kind of brings why social entrepreneurship is necessary, or at least helpful. That with this distributed knowledge, you had a kind of a requirement or a need for distributed agency. You had these indigenous entrepreneurs that were really culturally savvy. They knew how to work in the institutions. They had institutions absent. It wasn't the optimal system, but they knew how to navigate those. But they didn't have the technical knowledge or the resources necessary sometimes to take full advantage of the market system. Then you had these investors and entrepreneurs who really wanted to help. And really wanted to invest, sometimes just for purely financial motives, but they didn't have any anthropological knowledge. They didn't really understand the culture. They didn't know how to operate in these systems where there was ineffective or inefficient institutions. And so it was frustrated through moral hazard, information asymmetry, and what we really needed to get to is there was this great knowledge arbitrage opportunity where the West had developed a lot of knowledge, a lot of innovation, that was being precluded from moving into these third world countries by, in essence, government failure. How could we get around that? And social entrepreneurship became kind of the answer in the sense that you had altruistically, philanthropically minded people in the West that wanted to help. They were willing to risk more of their investment to make this difference happen. But they expected it to, they expected the beneficiaries to be accountable and to operate at a profit so that their investment was sustainable, that it would continue. And this notion of non-loss organization in which you're doing, you're contributing, but you don't want that money to be, charity. You don't want it to just go away. You want it to be sustainable. This kind of hybrid model started to develop. It was different than nonprofit, but I'm going to run out of time. Let me see if there's anything I just want to wrap up with. I'll just jump to the last point that goes to the opposite. So I've railed a lot of, against the kind of the leftist, but I found that my colleagues on, I won't say the right because that's absolutely wrong, but small government, kind of libertarian-leaning colleagues suffer from a problem that I saw today downstairs, and that's that when we see social entrepreneurship political, almost scoffing at it like it's wasteful, it's inefficient. But freedom from oppressive government is just meaningless unless you use the freedom to do something, the freedom to enact some change, to make something better than was out there before. Social entrepreneurship is not an oxymoron. It's not anti-capitalist, and it doesn't need to be those things. It can be philanthropical, for-profit entrepreneurship. Most entrepreneurs don't pursue the highest, most profitable option out there. Very few of us have done that. If you were doing that, you probably wouldn't be an Austrian economist. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. We match out what are our interests, what are our strengths, what are our moral incentives, social incentives, economic incentives, what's the best out of there, and how can I match that and make that pay off the best. That's the opportunity we pursue, and I believe that's where social entrepreneurship can really fit well with kind of a libertarian position of charity, of helping, philanthropy. So I'll leave it with that. I've got a lot more we can talk about.